Monday, there were still lots of reactions from the U.S. missile strike in Baghdad that killed the top Iranian general Qassem Soleimani. AP's Ben Thomas.
Hundreds of thousands of people flooded streets in Iran Sunday to walk alongside a casket carrying the remains of Revolutionary Guard General Qassem Soleimani. He was the leader of its Expeditionary Quds Force, which organizes Tehran's proxy forces around the Middle East. Iran's parliament opened with lawmakers chanting, "Death to America."
Oh, yeah, Trump.
Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani said President Trump had committed a big crime. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tells ABC's This Week,
"We've told the Iranian regime enough. You can't get away with using proxy forces and think your homeland will be safe and secure. We're going to respond against the actual decision makers."
Meanwhile, Iraq's parliament is calling for the expulsion of U.S. troops from the country in response to the attack. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Also, Iran says it no longer limits the number of centrifuges used to enrich uranium. A virtual abandonment of the 2015 nuclear deal. Later Sunday, as VOA's Arash Arabasadi explains, U.S. officials were still justifying the attack.
Skeptics call the evidence for a Soleimani-led major attack razor-thin and say it puts Americans at risk. Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the strike came at just the right time.
The senior leaders who had access to all of the intelligence, there was no skepticism. The intelligence assessment made clear that no action, allowing Soleimani to continue his plotting and his planning, his terror campaign, created more risk than taking the action that we took last week.
Trump says he does not want war with Iran. But Saturday on Twitter, he threatened strikes against Iranian cultural sites if Iran strikes back. A war crimes violation of the Geneva Convention.
That's VOA's Arash Arabasadi reporting. And this is VOA News.
Durante Dios, ante el pueblo de Venezuela.
Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido speaking after his supporters re-elected him as head of Congress from a remote location. They were blocked from entering the parliament building by forces still controlled by President Nicolas Maduro. Pro-government legislators seized control of Venezuela's opposition-dominated legislature Sunday, moving to install a backer of President Nicolas Maduro as National Assembly president, while government security forces blocked the opposition lawmakers. U.S. and many other world leaders have acknowledged Guaido as Venezuela's legitimate leader. Islamic extremists killed three U.S. military personnel Sunday when they attacked a military base used by U.S. and Kenyan forces along the border with Somalia. The extremists stormed past a perimeter surrounded by the Manda Bay airfields, destroying several U.S. aircraft and a number of vehicles before U.S. and Kenyan forces beat them back. We get more from VOA's Mohammed Youssef.
Islamist group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the Sunday attack. In a statement, the U.S. military command in Africa, known as AFRICOM, confirmed some of the smoke could have originated from the destruction of equipment at the base. In a statement, Al-Shabaab said it had taken control of part of the camp and it had inflicted casualties in the attack. Kenya Defense Forces also said in a statement they fought off the attackers and four militants were killed. Mohammed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
At least 30 people have been killed in an attack on a Libyan military academy, Julian Satterite reports.
The health ministry said Sunday that the toll was likely to rise, with many more injured. Libya's capital faces growing conflict. It's under the control of the internationally recognized Government of National Accord, but faces an offensive by the rival Libyan National Army, or LNA. Forces allied with the government blamed it for Saturday's attack, which they called an aerial bombing. The foreign ministry called for LNA chief Khalifa Haftar to be referred to the International Criminal Court. They say he's guilty of crimes against humanity.
Japan's justice minister vowed Monday to strengthen border departure checks and review bail conditions after Nissan's former chairman Carlos Ghosn fled the country. Masako Mori told reporters at a news conference the ministry has already acted to prevent a recurrence, but declined to give the details. Ghosn skipped bail while waiting trial on various financial misconduct allegations and later said from Lebanon that he did not escape to injustice. Mori declined to say who might be responsible for such a high-profile flight. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Three Americans have been killed in Sunday's Al-Shabaab attack on a U.S. military base in Kenya.
I think that it's an indication that very soon we need to beef up security in all international installations within our boundaries, because now Al-Shabaab are not only targeting Kenyan concerns, but they're also looking at the partners that Kenya is working with in fighting them.
George Musamali is a Kenyan security consultant. Liberian police say they will provide security to anti-government protesters today, Monday. Nigeria's opposition PDP says President Buhari should set a good example about Nigerians seeking medical treatment abroad. And will women do better to lead Malawi than their male counterparts?
I think it's a very, very important development if we could have a woman to stand in the main political parties, because the challenges that are facing Malawi are challenges that are best understood by women.
Jesse Kabuila is a professor at University of Malawi Chancellor College, and is China's growing presence in Africa leading to a death trap for most African countries? The story plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. One U.S. serviceman and two contractors with the U.S. Department of Defense were killed after Al-Shabaab extremists overran a key military base used by U.S. counter-terror forces in Kenya early Sunday morning. The U.S. Africa Command issued a statement late Sunday saying the militants destroyed several U.S. aircraft and vehicles before they were repelled. The Al-Shabaab attack came days after a U.S. airstrike killed Iran's top military commander, and Iran vowed retaliation. George Musamali is a Kenyan security consultant.
The latest is that the State Department of Defense has confirmed that we have one American serviceman and two Department of Defense contractors that were killed in the Manda attack. The attack was largely repulsed, but the fact that we have casualties clearly shows that there was a lot of planning and coordination in the attack that was carried out by the Al-Shabaab.
I know that Kenya has had its problems with Al-Shabaab. This attack is coming on the heels of the U.S. attack or the killing of the commander of the Iraqi forces there. So is there any connection here with what happened in Kenya and the killing of the Iraqi commander?
I'm not seeing any connection from experience. This kind of an attack, and if you look at the magnitude of the attack, it clearly shows it took a lot of planning and a lot of resources. So this is not something that was planned yesterday after the killing of the Iran commander by the Americans. Probably it might have catalyzed the attack, but I don't think it's anything related to this. This is something that was planned for a long time. I think that it's a coincidence that it came closely after the killing of the Iranian attack by the Americans. So I'm not seeing any relationship, though people are trying to put the relationship there. But from my end, if I look at the way terror attacks are planned and carried out, it could not have come very quickly like it has happened. And then the magnitude of the attack itself also shows that there was a lot of planning that was carried out before this attack was done.
I know that the Al-Shabaab has its beef with the Kenyan military because of Kenya's involvement in Somalia. So do you think they are going after Kenya or they are going after the Americans?
Basically, they are going for both Kenya and the Americans, because Kenya and the Americans have been partners in the war against Al-Shabaab. Remember, so many of Al-Shabaab commanders have been killed by drones that are operated by the Americans. So clearly, carrying this attack at a joint camp that is managed by the Kenyans and the Americans clearly shows that they are trying to show that you Americans have joined Kenya in fighting us. So basically, you also have to suffer the consequences. So I think that it's an indication that very soon we need to beef up security in all international installations within our boundaries, because now Al-Shabaab are not only targeting Kenyan concerns, but they're also looking at the partners that Kenya is working with in fighting them.
I read somewhere where I think it said that Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility. What is the Kenyan government saying? Well, first of all, let me say, what is Al-Shabaab saying?
Al-Shabaab have claimed responsibility, and that is as far as they have gone. And on the other end, the Kenyan government has also given a statement that this attack actually was carried out And the Kenyan government is saying that attackers were repulsed and several terrorists killed. That is as far as they have said, but they say that security along the Kenyan-Somali border in Lamu has been beefed up. So we are expecting more action, to see more action by the Kenyan Defense Forces in the areas around Lamu and Manda Island.
Josh Musamale is a Kenyan security consultant. He was speaking with us from Nairobi. Malawian female activists say there is a need for women leadership in Malawi, beginning with the 2024 presidential election, because they say women are less corrupt, more caring, and will better protect the country than their male counterparts. Jesse Kabuela is a professor at University of Malawi Chancellor College. She says if Malawians are tired of poverty and want change, they should do what former U.S. President Barack Obama has suggested, elect women in 2024.
I think it's a very, very important development if we could have a woman to stand in the main political parties, because the challenges that are facing Malawi are challenges that are best understood by women. Our challenge has been poverty, and a lot of feminist poverty. So I think if we had women in the leadership position, in the presidential, at least, you know, if we could have a 50-50, where if a man is standing, then the vice should be a woman, and if a woman is standing, the vice should be a man, I think it would go a long way to actually see the 50-50 principle. Not only will it help in role modeling, I think the more people see that Joyce Banda was not a fluke, we were the first in the SADC region to have a woman president, I think it would be good to have a follow-up, and that would show that we are truly a country that understands that leadership is something that women have too. However, I hasten to add, this cannot happen if in the political parties we are not following affirmative action at political party at the grassroots structure level.
But, Professor, wouldn't that be a form of quota system? Are you suggesting that, there should be a quota system?
Yes. I'm a big, big fan of different forms of affirmative action. I just believe that you need to find the type that best suits your context, and at the same time also have affirmative action programs to beef up the people who get into politics through affirmative action.
You mentioned former President Joyce Banda. Some people will say, yeah, okay, Joyce Banda was a woman, and under her leadership, there was cash gate. So isn't that equivalent to a man leading where there's corruption?
Yeah, cash gate is definitely equivalent to corruption. But I think people must be very careful to not reduce Joyce Banda to the corruption issue that was there. And corruption has not only been there under Joyce Banda. In Malawi, we've got cash gate A, we've got cash gate B, we've got different forms of cash gate. And if we are to say, let's have a woman there and men there, I'm telling you, the men who have ruled this country have had their fair share of cash gates. In fact, I would argue that if you look at way back to where this problem started, no, out of all the presidents which we've had, if we are to be truly honest, cash gate and corruption has been an issue for everybody. It is not unique to Joyce Banda. And I dare say the men are more to blame for this cash gate. You see, the problem is when women are being judged, they are judged very harshly. You make one mistake and everybody says, you see, this is what women do. When two women are actually debating, discussing politics or something, and two men are talking there, I'm telling you, people will say the men are having a debate and the women will be saying, oh, they're shouting at each other. The way we are judged in politics is painful to actually behold. So if you ask me, cash gate was a problem, is a form of corruption, and is not something that we are proud of to have happened during the tenure of President Joyce Banda. But it is not to be leveled to her alone.
Jesse Kabuela is a professor at the University of Malawi Chancellor College. Today is Monday, January 6th, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. The Liberian government says it will provide security to anti-government protesters today, Monday, but the government says it will hold the leadership of the Council of Patriots or any group liable under the law for any violation of the law during unauthorized protests. government. The government had proposed Saturday, January 4th, for the protest, but the organizers, the Council of Patriots, rejected the offer. Patrick Sudu is the Inspector General of the Liberian National Police.
As usual, we are under obligation by law to provide security for all of our citizens, including residents. So we are providing security to the general public.
You were saying earlier about a Saturday date being given to the protesters. That does not matter. You still provide security if they come out on Monday.
Yeah. Well, they were doing January 4th to protest and they refused to protest on January 4th. And they decided to come on Monday, January 6th. We have still under obligation to ensure that we give them protection, that we do all of the protests. We are not only under obligation to give them protection, but we are giving protection to those who are not really part of the protests, including residents of Liberia. So we will definitely give them protection while they are carrying on the protests. The reason why the dates and time are given for people to protest, it does not mean that they are infringing upon their rights. When you request for a permit or you request to have a protest, the government will have to pay because according to the Constitution, they have a right to protest peacefully according to Article 7 of the Constitution. But if I say Article 13 of the Constitution also gives the right to all citizens to live about freedom of all Indians. So this is the reason why when you attend a protest, you have to notify the government. So it is a duty, that space, that environment, that you will not be able to push on the rights of other people. But you also appeal to them to demean themselves and to also have control over the guards that are bringing out the protest. Because anything short of the expectation that we have for them, in a field, will be answerable to the law.
But, Inspector General, if you say that the protesters are responsible or liable for anything that will be associated with any violation of the laws of Liberia, well, that's why the police are supposed to be there, to make sure that nothing goes wrong.
Yeah, okay, the police will be there as usual. It is not the fault of the government to have such a protest. The police will be there to ensure that the police protest, but they do, on the other hand, they are charged with the responsibility to control this and the Benin street. I'm saying this because the protest started from a step down campaign to now a peaceful protest. So the first thought that we guys have from the step down campaign, if they want to really defeat the first thought, then of course they will start to get other order. So this is why we are appealing to them to ensure that they will demean themselves. We from the law enforcement bargain and joint together will ensure that we are calling all due courtesy and we ensure that the march will go on peacefully.
Inspector General, thank you very much. We are so happy to speak with you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Patrick Sudu is the Inspector General of the Liberian National Police. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, says President Muhammadu Buhari should set a good example against Nigerians seeking medical treatment abroad. President Buhari said Sunday that Nigerians going abroad for medical treatment is not good for the country and must stop. He also said his administration has paid attention to the health of Nigerians and will continue to do so with the commissioning of projects. The president made the comments through his Minister of Science and Technology during the inauguration of some projects at the Alex Ikweme Federal University Teaching Hospital. Kola Oluboniyan is the National Publicity Secretary of the Opposition People's Democratic Party of Nigeria.
For us in the People's Democratic Party, we consider the report drawn from the statement by the Minister of Science as self-indicting, and it raises a public apprehension on the high level of defeat in government in Nigeria. Because for us in the party, we see Mr. President as somebody who had frequently went on medical abroad and has also gone for checkups. So it is strange that he will now turn around to pontificate to other citizens of our country against foreign treatment or foreign medical. It's strange to us.
The president said that his administration has been paying close attention to the health of Nigerians and that he will continue to do so by commissioning projects. What do you make of that?
We are not talking about commissioning of projects. We are talking about a president who has repeatedly traveled abroad for medical turning around to pontificate to Nigerians on the need not to go abroad for medicals. In as much as the People's Democratic Party is not supporting medical tourism, but what we are seeing is that Mr. President and his party, the All Progressives Congress, must make medical available to the ordinary Nigerians who cannot afford to travel abroad for medicals. And that we are saying that in the last 5 years that Mr. President has assumed office, he has gone abroad on the ground of medicals more than any citizen of the country. And as such, we do not expect him to make a turnaround and be pontificating to those who don't even have the capacity to participate or to even draw from the medical situation in our country. So what we are suggesting is that if Mr. President, during his next medical checkup, should use one of the medical institutions in Nigeria so that he can understand what the ordinary Nigerians pass through.
The president said that the reason he made the comment there is because he feels that traveling abroad for medical attention is costly to most Nigerians.
Well, it would have been very, very needless for Mr. President to consider traveling abroad for medical in the first place if he had built on the development established by the previous administration. For instance, under the PDP government, we established a comprehensive national strategic health development plan. We had the Saving 1 Million Lives Initiative. We have the National Health Insurance Scheme. We also ensure the building of tertiary medical institutions like federal medical centers across the state. What we are seeing as a party, the People's Democratic Party, is that if Mr. President in his administration and that his party had built upon these thresholds, there would have been no need for Nigerians to be undergoing the pains that they go through in seeking medical.
Thank you very much again. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much, and happy New Year to you.
Kola Ologbadinya is the National Publicity Secretary of the Opposition People's Democratic Party of Nigeria. He was speaking with us from Ontario, Canada. The public debt of most African countries is growing rapidly. This coincides with the emergence of China as the biggest financial backer of African infrastructure projects, such as Kenya's new railway. China has replaced the West as the continent's primary creditor. This means debt that many economists say is unsustainable and in some cases impossible for some countries to ever pay. Viewer's Darren Taylor is in Johannesburg, looks at China's role in the ballooning debt of some African countries.
Africa owes China tens of billions of dollars, and the numbers are swelling by the second. Kenya, for example, has a public debt of about $60 billion. Much of it's owed to China for the construction of several infrastructure projects. Kenyan development economist Anzete Were says African states find Chinese loans attractive, primarily because Beijing doesn't dictate terms for a project and lecture about human rights or good governance, as many Western lenders do.
When you deal with European and North American governments, they have a very clear idea of how they think development should happen. It's sort of this feeling that if you use our money, we want you to do it this way. African governments have really become quite tired of that.
She says China's own dramatic economic growth adds incentive to borrowers in Africa. Were says China's rise tells African governments that the path to economic progress isn't all about free markets and democracy, which the West emphasizes. South African risk analyst Ronak Gopaldas warns against what he calls the myth that borrowing from China is easy, even though its loans involve less stringent conditions.
Whilst African leaders feel that they get a certain level of respect from China that they don't get from the West, there's no free lunch. And if they're unable to service their debt obligations, there will be consequences which could potentially undermine their sovereignty.
In Zambia, China has lent heavily for airport and power projects, and there are concerns those assets could come under Chinese control as the Lusaka government struggles to pay its debts. There's also growing concern on the continent and in the West that China will soon control much of tiny Djibouti, where Beijing has lent funds for ports and pipelines.
Djibouti's geostrategic position is very, very important. There's huge contestation amongst global partners around having a naval and military base there. It straddles the Indian Ocean, the Red Sea. It's very important to China. It's very important to European powers. It's very important to the Arab world as well, just given...
Djibouti has access to the Suez Canal, the shortest trade route between East and West. Gobeldas says if the West loses even partial access to the canal, it would suffer immense economic damage.
That's VOA's Darren Taylor reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Africa's hosting here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Awards scheduled for Tuesday in Cairo, the Egyptian capital. Liverpool forward and Egyptian international Mohamed Salah will be looking to bag a hat-trick of CAF Player of the Year awards on home soil when he battles for the coveted crown alongside Liverpool teammate Sadio Mane, who he beat to the award in 2018, and Algeria's Riyad Mahrez at the annual awards ceremony. Ahead of the awards, I caught up with some sports fans who told me who the likely winner will be.
I think I'll give it to Sadio Mane. Having won the UEFA Champions League one and also getting to the final of the Africa Cup of Nations, and also the ISO scorer in the English Premier League, I think he deserves it.
Riyad Mahrez, for me, deserves it. He was part of the Manchester City side that won the Premier League back-to-back, and of course, they won the FA Cup. So for me, I think it's going to be a fantastic, way to cap the year for Riyad Mahrez.
I think I would say Sadio Mane. Mane has really worked so hard. He has done so well at the Nations Cup and then at the UEFA Champions League.
The Crested Cranes of Uganda have started preparations for their first round of the FIFA Under-17 Women World Cup due in India this year. The Crested Cranes, who were recently crowned CECAFA champions, are in camp preparing to take on Ethiopia in the first ever FIFA Under-17 Women World Cup qualifier on Saturday. Head coach Ayub Khalifa speaks on the fitness of the girls ahead of the crucial encounter.
We have started our training. It has been our first session. It has been good. We are actually looking at their fitness. These girls have been down. They have not been training, most of them. So we are trying to check on their fitness. Then we had some small ball work to check on how they've been performing out there.
Elsewhere, the Ghana Football Association president, Kurt Okraku, says the association decided to sack coaches of all its national teams in order to inject new life into the nation's sports. The football's governing body had on Friday announced that it was dissolving all coaching units of both the male and female teams. Black Stars coach James Kwesi Appiah, home-based Black Stars trainer Maxwell Konadu, men's under-23 boss Ibrahim Tanko, and senior national women's team coach Mercy Tago Kwaku are among the casualties.
We announced a change in direction for all our national teams, technical-wise. We have changed the direction. I think we used to be in gear one. We need to move to another gear. And that's what people are waiting for. Big announcement happened, was it 48 hours ago? Oh. Yes, I'm sure in the new week we'll have a clear direction.
Ghana's last major trophy at any level of international football remains their success at the 2009 FIFA Under-20 World Cup in Egypt. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sport. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good day. And that is it for this Monday, January 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very productive week.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.